What's up, Wisconsin? I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to the Civic Media Network. Really excited to bring on a special guest. If you've been listening, don't worry. I'm going to go back to the discussion of forensic sciences and in our legal system. But right now, I'm really excited to bring on my friend and yours, candidate for the 14th Assembly District, Brady Couthard. Hey, Brady, how you doing?
Good. How are you, Maggie?
Really nice to see you again. You are in the midst of the nomination signature process. What are nomination signatures? How many do you have to get? How are you going about doing it?
It's a whole thing. And, you know, it's democracy at its finest. It's one of those fun processes that is really tedious, but really essential. Essentially, what we're doing as candidates, every candidate has to do this except Joe Biden and Donald Trump, presidential candidates, are going around asking folks in their districts to sign, basically saying that they want to see them on the ballot. It doesn't necessarily mean that they'll vote for them, but it's just a commitment saying that they would like to see this candidate on the ballot. There are certain rules that you can only sign for one candidate per race. You can only circulate papers for one candidate per race, and you have to live in the district, be a voter in the district. So there are lots of funky rules about that. And it's a lot of fun doing it. Our campaign went around and knocked a bunch of doors in the district to do that, just asking folks, you know, what issues they cared about, and then asking them to sign my nomination papers to be their next representative. Not necessarily voting for me, but just to see my name on the ballot. Yesterday, we took those to the election commission to certify ballot placement. So that was very exciting.
Well, congratulations on turning in your signatures. And I want to be sure people get one thing really clear. You can sign more than one set of nominating papers in an election cycle, but you may only sign one set of nominating papers per elected office, right? So you can't sign nominating papers for every single person that wants to run for the 14th Assembly District. If you sign Brady's, you can only sign Brady's. I just wanted to be really clear about that because, folks, you may run into to different candidates trying to get on the ballot, and you got to be real clear about that. The other thing I wanted to emphasize is you must live in the district if you are signing a nomination paper. Otherwise, if you get it wrong, don't worry about it. It's not your problem. It's the wannabe candidates, because your signature will not count. So if you want to participate, when in doubt, you can go ahead and feel free to sign those. The other thing I wanted to reemphasize that you said, Brady, was simply because you sign somebody's nominating paper doesn't mean you're obligated to vote for them. In fact, you can maybe intend not to vote for them, but you want them on the ballot for some reason, or just because you like to see good contested primaries. That's okay, too. You do not have to vote for the candidate of which you sign their nominating papers. Did I get any of that wrong, Brady?
That sounds exactly right to me. I think one thing that's really important to emphasize is even, like, Senator Tammy Baldwin has to collect nomination papers, even though she's an incumbent. And it is a statewide office. She has to collect nomination signatures as well. Eric Hovde will have to collect nomination signatures. The only folks that don't are, like, the presidentials who go through, like, the party selection process.
Yep.
But all of us candidates are out there doing it. And you can make your voice heard by signing these papers. It's an essential part of democracy.
It is. And since you mentioned Eric Hovde, I can't help myself. We have a little bit of sound from Eric Hovde. Apparently, the man has a wee bit of the problem remembering, you know, the words to the Pledge of Allegiance. I thought you might get a kick out of taking a listen here. Calvin, can we take a listen to cut number three if you got it there, friend?
Thank you. We're all so blessed to be part of the greatest country in the history of mankind, America. America has given more prosperity, freedom to its people than any country in the history of the world. It not only saved the world once, but twice in the last century from oppression and tyranny. I'm proud to be an American. I love my country. So let's say the Pledge of Allegiance together. I pledge the allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you.
Amen.
God bless America. Go Slinger Speedway.
Forgets the one nation under God part, but then makes up for it with a rousing amen at the end. Oh,
it's tough.
Sorry to take up a couple. Yeah, I mean, and pledge of allegiance. Very strange. Very strange. I don't know about you, but I've been saying the pledge since I was a wee bit of a thing. And most of us know that one pretty pat. But enough about Hovde. Had to get in a little bit of fun. You've been knocking a lot of doors, Brady. You're running for the 14th Assembly District. First of all, for folks that don't know, what areas in the 14th Assembly District, and what are you telling folks your candidacy is about when you're knocking the doors?
Yeah, so the 14th District is a brand new district. After Governor Evers signed new maps into law, it created a brand new district. So these folks have, and our neighbors have, a brand new representative. This includes the majority of West Allis, a little bit of Milwaukee, and a little bit of Wauwatosa. We're kind of like the western side of Milwaukee County. It goes to the New Berlin border. It's a very exciting district because for a long time, West Allis was kind of split up between a bunch of representatives. And now West Allis will have primarily one representative, with a little bit going to District 7, which was Dan Reamer's seat, who is now retiring from the Assembly. So that is kind of the landscape and where we're at. I'm introducing myself as the person who's rising to the occasion for the opportunity, right? We have this opportunity at the hand to elect a solid Democrat to the State Assembly. We need leadership that is going to rise to the occasion for working families, future generations, and Wisconsin at large. I'm a seventh generation Wisconsinite. My parents were a working class household. My dad was an iron worker and a carpenter. My mom was a waitress turned small business owner. So I grew up in a family that knew what it was like living paycheck to paycheck, and also the struggles of healthcare, finding good healthcare, and also appreciating the benefits of the union when the union worked best for us. Since 2018, I've been involved with politics at the local, state, and federal level, and really have built a lot of relationships that I believe will help our district and me as a legislator, as we're like working in the legislature, right? Like anyone who's trying to deliver services, which is really the core job of a representative, is delivering services, needs to have the relationships at the local, state, and federal level to make that happen. And I've built a lot of those relationships over my time in politics. Governor Evers appointed me to the Higher Educational Aides Board in 2018, or not in 2018, while I was in college. And that is when I took concrete action to expand financial aid access for college students and helped families navigate loan repayment during the COVID-19 pandemic. So these are like tangible experience leadership that I can bring to the legislature. And there's also energy in my leadership as a young person running for office that is very attractive to folks on the door. Our message is resounding. We're really focused on our public schools and public health and public safety. And it's going great.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that, Brady. You know, full disclosure to everybody, I've worked with Brady in the past. I think he's an amazing, amazing human being. And I have endorsed you, so I don't want to hide the ball on that. Happy and very proud to endorse you, Brady. Coulthard candidate for Wisconsin State's 14th Assembly District, recently redrawn with our new legislative maps. Just submitted his signatures yesterday to get on the ballot. My guest for this segment of the Maggie Dawn Show. You mentioned education. I know we are struggling to have enough teachers, diversity in teacher ranks. It's sort of, you name it, paying teachers enough. real wages for teachers have gone down, has gone down 19% since 2010. What are you hearing from people as you knock doors, specifically about teachers in the state and our education system? Because that's something, I don't care who I'm talking to, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, I don't care about politics, folks. Everybody wants our schools to work well for our communities.
Yeah, I've heard that a lot on the doors. It's actually probably the number one issue I hear from folks on the doors. There is a referendum that will be up on the ballot in November for West Allis, West Milwaukee schools. And a big part of that referendum will be increasing teacher pay so that it is competitive with neighboring districts. Because why would teachers want to stay in the West Allis school district if they can go to New Berlin or another neighboring school district that can pay them more? And then, you know, when we think about the memories that kids have and our memories as students, a lot of them are built around teachers and staff and, you know, someone in the school system that made an impact on our lives. And if those people are cycling out every year, that's not really building a great school system for our kids. So that is something that the referendum is seeking to focus on. Now, what the state legislature needs to be proactive so that the funding doesn't have to go to referendum. There's a lot of stress about this referendum because people don't necessarily think it's fair that their property taxes or whatever are going to have to, you know, they're going to have to pay the bill when the state has the right and the state constitution says that the state has to pay for public education and every child has a right to education. So now why are we asking taxpayers to do it? So as a state legislature, we are wanting to fund it ahead of time, and that includes prioritizing recruiting and retaining staff.
Yeah, so we can get away from the gosh darn referendums every election cycle. Yes. Where can people find out more about you, Brady?
www.bradyforassembly.com.
That's Brady Coulthard, candidate for Wisconsin State's 14th Assembly District. You will see him on the primary ballot August 13th. You heard from him here. Thanks so much, Brady. I'm Maggie Dawn. We'll be back with more in just a moment. This is why. Welcome back, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Network. My thanks to Brady Coulthard, candidate for Wisconsin State Assembly's 14th District. You're going to find him on your primary ballot this coming August 13th. Thanks, Brady, for being here with us. But I've been spending the majority of this show talking about, frankly, bias in the medical examiner profession. This discussion was kicked off and frankly took over my show plan for today because an article came out yesterday in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, reporter Ashley Lutheran talking about the dismissal of a homicide charge involved in a baby's death because the autopsy by Milwaukee County's former medical examiner, Dr. Brian Peterson, did not meet the standards of the National Association of Medical Examiners. So the case ended up getting tossed. There was insufficient tissue preserved to do further testing after Dr. Peterson's retirement. And I use that to pivot into a discussion more broadly about what goes on within the medical examiner industry, if you will. And this is part of a broader question that I wanted us all to take some time to think about and reflect upon. If you've got questions or comments, you'd like to join our conversation, 855-75-CIVIC. That's 855-752-4842. And I separate things out into sort of two phenomena over the last 30 years. There's the Law and Order phenomenon where everybody thinks, you know, all cops are Olivia Benson and Lenny Briscoe fearlessly pursuing the truth wherever it leads. And of course that all prosecutors are Jack McCoy and will stand up if they think a defendant's being railroaded. And again, the vast majority of prosecutors and police go to work every day and operate in good faith, but we're humans and biases occur. So there's the Law and Order effect. There's also the CSI effect, which is people expect forensic evidence in cases now. And when it is presented, often by a medical examiner who is a doctor, so doctor thus and such, juries tend to credit that medical, scientific, forensic testimony quite a bit. And so the question of whether or not a medical examiner may have some bias is a really important one. And what we've been exploring is that, as a point of fact, medical examiners determine the manner of death, of which there can only be five: suicide, homicide, natural causes, accident, or undetermined. And that determination of manner of death is inherently subjective. That's really important. And there was a study that came out and was published in 2020 that showed that medical examiners were five times more likely to conclude that a manner of death was, for a black child, a homicide versus a white child, though given identical scientific and biological and medical information. The only thing that differed in that study was the race of the child and who was caretaking for the child at the time. That is pretty incredible if you think about it. A five times greater likelihood to conclude that something's a homicide when that determination is what triggers investigations, what likely is necessary before a criminal prosecution. And if you put that on its head and you think about that in the context of officer-involved deaths, where someone dies as they're interacting with police, well, if medical examiners have a bias to favor police for whatever set of reasons, perhaps just because we're human beings and medical examiners work with district attorneys and police every day, that should be of some concern to us. And again, when we look at things like bite mark evidence, hair fiber evidence, arson flame fire pattern evidence, ballistics matching, even fingerprinting, eyewitness testimony, a lot of these areas of law enforcement, of expert forensic scientific evidence, have been drawn into, frankly, question and often sharp criticism as of late. Listen, it's hard when you are a practitioner and someone says your outcomes may not be reliable or you may be suffering from bias. Our human reaction is, oh, of course not. I'm objective and independent. But when you are a practitioner of forensic pathology or any forensic science, and you are participating in the prosecution that will deprive people of their liberty, shouldn't we be humble enough to say, well, wait a minute, if I am biased, what can I do about that? Don't I want to understand that? And what's shocking is that the response to the study that came out in 2020 from the medical examiner community was to try to shut it down, to try to challenge and personally and professionally attack the scientists that published that study. Now, let me just give you an example of some of these things that I'm talking about. There's two examples in forensic sciences that I think prove the point that we need to be maybe taking a much, much harder look at this and other forensic sciences. The first example is, quote, shaken baby syndrome. This theory put hundreds, if not thousands, of people in prison before scientists that worked outside of the legal system proved that the symptoms that medical examiners were concluding were indicators of shaken baby syndrome and could only be caused by violent shaking of a baby Oh, yeah, those symptoms, yeah, they could also be caused by things like falls or illness. There may still be people sitting in prisons that were convicted off of medical examiner testimony over shaken baby syndrome. The other so-called scientific potential complicating factor for cause of death, not manner, but cause, is this thing that's called excited delirium, which no one outside of forensic pathology had ever talked about. And yet it showed up in case after case after case, and showed up especially in cases where Black and brown folks died while in the custody of police. Now, I don't even know what the heck it is. Neither does the American Medical Association, because, oh yeah, the AMA never had that as a condition or a thing. And, oh yeah, come to find out that the origins of excited delirium, yeah, that really is a concept caught on after a company that was formerly known as Taser spent millions and millions of dollars to promote it among coroners and medical examiners. I wonder why a company formerly known as Taser would want to promote a cause of death called excited delirium amongst coroners and medical examiners. Well, give a think on that when we come back. Your farm update is next. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome back, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Network. I'm talking about forensic sciences, specifically forensic pathology, medical examiners, and their role in the justice system, in the legal system, and the potential biases that may exist. What sparked all this off was that just about a month ago, a Milwaukee district attorney had to dismiss homicide charges because the work of Milwaukee County's former medical examiner, Dr. Brian Peterson, was found to be lacking, not at standard. This led me down a path of looking into a study that came out right around the time of Derek Chauvin's prosecution for the murder of George Floyd, which basically proved that medical examiners have a cognitive bias. And there's been a Not only did that study prove it, there's been a couple of subsequent studies. Now, what was interesting that in response to that study, many forensic pathologists refused to humbly embrace the findings, refused to say, well, how do we do this better? In fact, one of the pathologists that attacked the people that did the study was former Milwaukee County medical examiner, Dr. Brian Peterson. Oh, and he was also a consulting expert for the defense for Derek Chauvin. But let's not make this about Dr. Peterson. The point is much broader. There have been a couple of ideas or causes of death that medical examiners have embraced in the last 15, 20 years that have been basically proven to be total hogwash. One I mentioned before our farm update, that's shaken baby syndrome. Again, medical experts and scientists outside of the legal system basically proved that the conclusions, the symptoms that medical examiners were using to conclude that shaken baby syndrome had occurred and that there was a homicide and the death could have only occurred from violent shaking. Oh, yep. That death could also have been caused by other factors like falls or illnesses. Interestingly enough, on this shaken baby syndrome issue. Investigations by ProPublica and the Metal Justice Project have also found that child deaths are far more likely to be classified as crimes in some states and counties versus others. This would suggest that such determinations perhaps aren't exactly grounded in science, but more in perhaps the personal priorities and biases of local police and prosecutors. That ain't a good thing, in my opinion. Now, I've been talking about this other debunked cause of death called excited delirium. It has come up a lot in the past. It had no place outside of forensic pathology. In fact, we came to know and understand that a taser company basically came up with this idea and then promoted it to forensic pathologists, spent millions doing so, and oh, all of a sudden we started to see it showing up as a cause of death. Basically, what excited delirium alleges is that people apprehended by police who are intoxicated, high, or just panicked and freaked out, or have ailments like heart disease or genetic conditions like a sickle cell trait, can go into cardiac arrest and then die when being restrained or apprehended by police through absolutely no fault of the police. Well, the problem was the AMA, the American Medical Association, never actually recognized it, nor did the American Psychiatric Association. Nope, not ever. And after 2020, both groups explicitly recommended against its use. Now, why might that be the case? Well, one of the co-authors of the study from 2020 showing bias amongst medical examiners, she gave us a potential reason. This is Dr. Joy Carter. She said, quote, and I read this before, but it's worthy of mention here in the context of this excited delirium. This is Joy Carter. It's a pattern with in-custody deaths. There's a knee-jerk desire to quickly clear police officers. Some medical examiners bend over backwards to blame these deaths, often on race-based conditions like sickle cell trait or excited delirium. These conditions, over time, provide effectively a shield that allows law enforcement officers to be more aggressive with black and brown folks. Again, this is deeply disturbing to me that a made-up thing was then used for years and years to permit medical examiners and law enforcement officers to avoid accountability for people that died in their custody. Now, what did the National Association of Medical Examiners say about this excited delirium, you may be asking yourself? Finally, in March of 2023, that association disavowed the diagnosis. It's about time. By the way, the California legislature has also banned coroners from citing excited delirium as a cause of death. I wonder how many black and brown people have died in an in-custody situation that had excited delirium put on their death certificates and who, as a consequence, never had much of an investigation or any investigation at all into their deaths because of a made-up thing. What are we talking about here? We're talking about cognitive bias. We all suffer from this. And again, the study that sort of kicked off all of this controversy, this debate, which I think is so important to have, the guy that ran that study, a cognitive scientist based out of London, he's done a couple more studies. They came up with some interesting results. In the first additional study, so after this 2020 study, medical examiners, again, were given identical autopsy reports, but half were accompanied by a police report suggestive of suicide, while the other half were given a police report suggestive of homicide. What do you think happened? The medical examiners were, of course, far more likely to give manner of death determination that matched the police reports, whether it was suicide or homicide. And in the third study in this series, published in September of 2023, Dr. Dror showed that when police give medical examiners just one theory of the crime, medical examiners are highly likely to agree with that theory. And if they provided more than one theory of the crime, medical examiners' analysis changed. I mean, this kind of makes sense, right? This is called confirmation bias. If somebody tells you the answer is this and then asks you to do an analysis, but they've already told you what the answer is and you work with them every day and you trust them and they're friends and they've become work colleagues, all else being equal, most of us are just wired to find our way in the analysis to match the answer to meet the outcome that we all expected. It's just the way our brains are wired. Now, here's what blows me away, right? Again, in the wake of this study in 2020, the National Association for Medical Examiners actually came out in a public statement and discouraged obtaining second opinions for forensic autopsies. I mean, what? I don't know about you, but if I get a big diagnosis from my doctor that might change the course of my life, I very may well go get a second opinion. As a lawyer, I encourage clients to seek second opinions. Yeah, you don't think I got it right? Please go talk to someone else. Now, part of the rub was in the George Floyd murder case against Derek Chauvin. George Floyd's family went out and got a second opinion. And just, again, as a bit of framework here, peer review, getting second opinions, yeah, that's sort of the linchpin, the baseline of both scientific and academic analysis. That's what you do. Now, there was a huge amount of criticism of the National Association of Medical Examiners, and eventually they retracted the statement. But the very fact of the statement is incredibly shocking to me. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Network. We're talking about biases, confirmation biases, cognitive biases in forensic science, specifically forensic pathology and its role in our legal system. There's been a number of important studies that have come out basically in the last 4 years that show indeed forensic pathologists, coroners, and medical examiners have biases. We've pointed out at least two sort of made-up things that in the case of shaken baby syndrome has put likely many people in prison, which scientists outside of law enforcement came to reveal as junk science, junk pathology. And on the flip side of things, we also talked about excited delirium, which is, again, a completely made-up thing that was used for many years to stop investigations into police involved in custody deaths in their tracks. Now, to me, all of this leads us to the place where we're wondering to ourselves, well, how do we make this better? First of all, I mentioned at the outset that the U.S. is the only developed nation in the world where medical examiners and coroners actually testify in court. So that would be one thing. Stop with the impressive doctor testimony in court, which, again, because of the CSI effect, juries tend to give a whole lot of credence to. The second thing is that medical examiners should be required to notify prosecutors and juries when a manner of death determination was influenced by non-medical information. In other words, when you go outside what is the biology or the science and you're considering the facts surrounding the death, you should have to disclose that. The third reform that some have suggested is that the U.S. adopt basically a less adversarial model of expert testimony again, that's unlikely to happen. It's largely what's used across Europe. In other words, prosecutors and defense attorneys are given equal access to medical examiners. They're not as closely aligned with police and district attorneys. The last potential reform that Dr. Dror, the author of these studies, and other critics who say this cognitive confirmation bias is a real problem, they call for reform that requires a process called, and this sounds like true academic stuff here, but I'll explain what it is, don't worry. They call for what is referred to as linear sequential unmasking, in which a medical examiner conducts an autopsy first, is given no other facts, and then only makes medical observations, no other information. And then in a piecemeal fashion is given other bits of non-medical, non-biologic, non-scientific information. In other words, the facts surrounding the death. Again, this is an effort to basically separate out what is objective medical decision-making or conclusions, observations, from what is much more, some would say, much, much more subjective. All of this matters, right? It matters a lot. Another example, and I began this afternoon talking about a young man who died in custody by the name of Damian Cameron. Another young man also died after George Floyd's murder. His name is Elijah McClain. He was a healthy 23-year-old black man who died after police stopped him, threw him to the ground, and restrained him. You've heard about this case. I'll give you the rest of the details surrounding Mr. McClain's death and what the coroner concluded after these brief messages. Don't go anywhere. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Network. Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Network. I've been talking today about forensic science and just the fact that human beings do very difficult jobs, and human beings are all subject to cognitive and confirmation biases. But the difference in our legal system is that, of course, these cognitive biases have the most devastating results imaginable. They can put people in prison for the rest of their lives, and they can also, on occasion, help bad actor law enforcement officers evade responsibility. There are many examples of this, but one of the more shocking is the death of a young man named Elijah McClain. He was a healthy 23-year-old black guy. He died. Police stopped him, threw him to the ground, restrained him, and then paramedics forcibly injected Mr. McClain with ketamine after officers at the scene had claimed he had been suffering from what? Excited delirium. After consulting with the police, the county coroner classified Mr. McClain's death as, quote, undetermined. And again, speculated that he may have died of excited delirium brought on by an undiagnosed medical condition. Citing the coroner's report, guess what the DA did? Oh, yep, cleared the officers of wrongdoing. But in the summer of 2020, Colorado Governor Jared Polis appointed a special prosecutor to investigate Mr. McClain's death. A grand jury subsequently found that police officers had no probable cause to stop Mr. McClain, and the autopsy report was amended to say that Mr. McClain died of complications of ketamine administration following forcible restraint. One officer has since been convicted of manslaughter, another acquitted. I will go to the phones. If you've got a comment or a question before the end of the hour, feel free to join us. 855 75 Civic. That's 855-752-4842. I've been largely drawing upon reporting by Radley Balko for the National Review that came out this past November. He closes this article by pointing out that there is a historical echo here. The reporter suggests this, that when the deaths of young black men like Damian Cameron and Elijah McClain, they're basically initially dismissed, and others continue to this day to be dismissed, it does invoke and remind us of an incredibly ugly racial history in our country, where clear lynchings of black people were classified as undetermined, accidental, suicide, or natural causes, which, as we've been talking about, when that is the matter of death determination by a coroner or medical examiner, it stops any investigation in its tracks. And he closed with this observation. When I first saw the coroner's report speculating that Elijah McClain, that his death might have been caused by an undiagnosed mental illness, I recalled a particularly chilling quote from one of the lynching cases in which a young black woman gave to the journalist John Howard Griffith back in 1954. She said this, "We couldn't even count the bullet holes in my brother's head," she said, "but they called it heart failure." We simply have to do better. Joanne from Madison, you're on the Maggie Dawn Show.
Amazing show. I've been riveted to every word. But I have a question. There are so many fictional TV shows that solve cases in an hour and all of that and wrap them all up. And these medical examiners have the information. Do you think that the public isn't aware of those complexities that you've been outlining? Because, again, we've been seduced by all those TV shows that draw us in and make us feel that everything could get wrapped up in a little bit of time.
Yeah, it's a great question, Joanne. And not to put bang the gavel or bang the table too hard metaphorically here, I think this genre, especially within TV crime, both dramas and, remember, Bad Boys, I think that has done incredible damage to our national psyche in terms of simply being able to have a conversation about what is the very human tendency towards confirmation bias, to wanting to think the best, perhaps, of people that we work with every day, and that it has made it so hard to meaningfully criticize or drawn to question some of these things like shaken baby syndrome, like excited delirium, which even sounds like complete garbage on its face, to have real conversations about wrongdoing by police, that those dialogues seem to all of a sudden get reduced down to, oh, well, then you want to defund the police, or you back the badge, as if people can't support police and expect police to be highly accountable. I really appreciate you listening, Joanne, and for your call. I think we've got to be able to do better. That's sort of my point here. Again, I think the vast majority of police officers, district attorneys, judges, medical examiners, and coroners go to work every day and operate in good faith. They're trying to do the right thing. Not all of them, but most of them. But the reality is that really terrible injustices have happened. And unless we care about all of those injustices, even when those injustices are perpetrated upon and wrought upon people that we may not relate to or may not resonate with us, who are extraordinarily different from we are, that may have even engaged in some level of wrongdoing themselves. But unless we hold those to account who operate in the legal system, who wield the power of the state, who wield the power to take away our liberties, what are we doing? I have a number of dear friends, grew up with folks that are police officers to this day. One of my best friends in the whole world married a cop. I love that man. And I want police officers and medical examiners and district attorneys to be held to the highest standards, because the great cops deserve that too. I'm Maggie Dawn. That's it for this episode. I'll be back tomorrow. Remember, I'll stand up for you. I hope you stand up for me. But it's always better when we stand together.
Keep on running, 'cause the winner don't quit on themselves.